One quick message before I start the show. You can find all the links and resources for this episode by visiting the show notes on rickyrichards.com. If you enjoy this episode, do consider subscribing on iTunes or Stitcher. And if you're feeling particularly generous, you can help me to grow the show by leaving a review on iTunes. For anyone who does subscribe, review or share, thank you. I appreciate it. Now let's get into the show. Welcome to Ricky Richards Represents, the show where I talk tips for success with leading figures of creativity and innovation. Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of the show. My guests today are James Cross and Tim Jones, creative directors at the highly acclaimed in-house creative shop that is BBC Creative, a newly formed creative shop that was launched in 2016 in response to the overwhelming success of 4Creative. Having worked together for 10 years, James and Tim have worked at numerous agencies from B&B to JWT and most notably McCann before joining the BBC Creative earlier this year. In this time, they've created just a few award-winning campaigns, which at last count amounted to nearly 130 awards. Even more extraordinary is that this creative feat was achieved outside the UK's creative capital, showing that the pair have more than just fortune at their feet, but genuine talent to boot. To share their experiences and talk in depth with me and to share some of their experiences of in-house creative, guys, welcome to the show.
Hi,
thank you. It's a nice intro.
Yeah. Well, you guys, that's what everyone always says, it feels like we've accomplished something when you get the intro.
Yeah, it's yeah, like,
this is your life
good,
moment.
Yeah.
Wait for Michael Aspel to walk in.
I apologise for having to start with something that we've talked about off mic, but you've just dropped like an absolute mother of a creative Christmas execution that's just ruminating across the internet at lightning speed. I thought we could kick off by talking about that. It's been a runaway success, but how did you know it was going to be so, and how did it come about?
I don't think you ever know it's going to be a runaway success, but I think it became quickly apparent. I think the first time Tim and I got a sneak peek at like a work in progress, you knew it was going to be pretty special.
Yeah.
And I think credit to the guys that did it, Arvid and Amar and Aidan Laurent. It's amazing. And yeah, it's done, you know, without too much bias, we kind of think it's the best Christmas ad.
I mean,
hands down, come on.
You guys are in the room here, but obviously, as every creative does in the industry, you always look to the creative commercials and try and sum up which one you think's the best.
Yeah. And I think I think what's great about it is it does its own thing. It tells such a simple story, but in a way that everyone can identify with. And I think that encapsulates the strength of what the BBC is. And I think, you know, where other brands might be losing their way a little bit in the Christmas minefield, and you know, it's tough. You know, having been agency side, it's a tough world to try and get something out. So to deliver something that's so good, so engaging, but is so true to the brand as well, I think is a real achievement.
Yeah, absolutely.
So talking about that, for the people listening that may not be familiar, we're talking about the commercial, which is this girl who she's dancing, her dad is busy, something we can all relate to. Where did the idea actually come from and its initial origin?
So, the creative team that worked on it had talked about it sort of as it was pretty much from the outset. There was obviously a lot of development. So it was, you know, it's one of those you start really early because you want time to, you expect there to be a lot of sort of back and forth and getting the idea right, crafting it. And it was pretty much, as soon as it was seen, it was that encapsulates BBC. So I think it came at a good time. So BBC and BBC One is kind of not rebranding itself, but has recently gone through a bit of a rebrand with the whole oneness campaign, and sort of the idents sort of kicked it off, and there was a real simple truth to get to. So I think that helped. That's what we needed to get to. This idea of what it's difficult because BBC, it's one thing that I'm struggling a little bit with, Bruce, but BBC is for everyone.
Yeah,
and that Christmas togetherness is kind of there from the outset, and it was just crafting the right story around that.
So I was going to say, I mean, people are going to compare this with all the other Christmas ads, but unlike the agencies out there that ultimately are trying to sell shoes or whatever, that, you know, there's an ulterior motive there. The BBC does have that freedom.
Yeah.
You say it encapsulates the BBC. Like, what makes you think that that is the case?
Well, yeah, like Tim said, so the BBC is kind of, you've got this awkward proposition that you're for everyone, which kind of makes it very hard to focus on things. But I think this ad, there's like a universal truth, like we spoke about in sort of the value of being together at Christmas. And I think it's kind of, I don't know, as a father myself, you can kind of relate to both characters a little
bit. Definitely,
And it's kind of, it's just relatable. And I think, you know, the ad does diversity without too much of a heavy hand, which, you know, it's very important. But I think your Rosie Arnold podcast, you were talking about it, and but it's like a nice subtlety. It's not even something you kind of register, I don't think. But
And I think it's kind of, the BBC is for everyone, but what they do really well is speak to really specific audiences at really particular times. But I think, like, everyone can identify in something in that, but it's like so universal. I mean, it's a tricky tightrope to walk. I think if you set out to try and deliver that in a single script, then you wouldn't get there. But I think it's a culmination of the really strong platform that it comes from, a really strong, simple story, but then the technique that's behind it, so the sort of the stop motion CGI animation.
We don't research the shit out of it as well. Like, so when you're in an ad agency, a traditional ad agency, everything gets researched and researched in our experience.
And oftentimes that research, it tends to be these small little pockets of groups, which I've got every creative, I think, has a bit of a love-hate relationship with it, because if it reinforces how good your idea is, you're on board, brilliant. Yeah. But oftentimes there's just a few people that can sway it, or, you know...
It's a difficult thing. It's held up as, you know... It's the way to get to the truth, and it's the way to get to what people really think. But I think if you put anyone in a room and show them something and say that they have to have an opinion, then they will have an opinion on it, whether that's really what they think. They just think they have to say something. And a room full of people, it's like lighting a spark as soon as one person says something. It was one of the big draws for us at the BBC when they approached us, is no pictures and no research.
On that, I mean, it's a slight tangent, but this isn't, as I mentioned earlier, it's not a traditional ad. It's more of a short film. It's a branded piece of content. Why did the BBC, which is a kind of publicly funded organisation, feel the need to have to create this thing anyway? Like, why even be in the game of kind of creating this?
There's always been a Christmas moment for BBC. You know, it's a huge part of the year for any broadcaster. And I think the BBC as well, and particularly with this, you know, with this oneness theme that the BBC now has, is more relevant than ever, that the BBC at Christmas is a time where everyone gets together. You know, it's something that you remember from your childhood, is sitting down after your Christmas dinner and everything, and sort of, you know, sitting down to whatever's on at the time, Only Fools and Horses or whatever it would have been. You know, it's a big moment, so I think it's a real relevant message. I think they've always had a presence at Christmas. I think the Christmas bubble has just expanded around them.
And this ad took, or ad, I shouldn't say that, this video, from reading a little bit about it, it took nearly or over a year to make.
I don't know about a year.
No, it was
April time, May time.
I remember seeing the first iteration of the script, sort of April time.
That's a fair run. I don't think, I mean, when we were at McCann, Aldi Christmas took kind of a similar gestation period. So
you guys briefly touched on how it was actually made earlier, but just for the audience, like, what?
Yeah, so it's stop motion animation, but then for the first time, or it's certainly the combination of it, so it's stop motion mannequins with CGI facial expressions, so those two worlds brought together. So I guess the real hard work's in the stop motion.
There's a making of video on YouTube, I'm reliably informed, which will blow your mind.
It's incredible.
That's quite a creative risk to take, to tread new ground in terms of delivery technique with something that, as you say, it's expected year in, year out. Mm-hmm. was that something that was experimented with and they decided to go with it, or did they know that from the start?
I think you've always got to take risks. I don't think you can just sort of rehash, you know, what's gone before. Sainsbury's with their Greatest Gift ad, which I think was last year, is relatively similar, not quite the same. But
I think it was one of those that they kind of they kind of came across, like, not, it was something. I know the CGI expressions was something that was developed as we went along, because it's just what's nice about stop motion is has that real nice warm charm to it brings, but then it also brings an element of like deadness to the expressions,
Sure.
And that, you know, this is such a joyful film that it needed more, and it needed something to be developed. So I think that's kind of where it came from, that it happened.
Yeah, these things, I think these things evolve, and then once you find a bit of magic, you sort of run with it. And
Well, fingers crossed for you guys and everyone at BBC Creative that it really does well for everyone.
Yeah, so far so good.
We'll transition into some of your work now, and you've done loads and loads and loads, and we could literally talk for hours about it. Yeah. There was one piece that particularly resonated with me a little bit, and it was the Mrs. Bog ad.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
and that came out of the fact that, I actually passed it on to my mom because I had a basketball history, and then there I am in advertising. So it was just like, you know, the perfect culmination of real life insight into the existence that I've had.
Yeah.
But one overarching trend that I think I've pieced together out of your portfolio is the fact that I believe that you guys must have come from real working class families, because it seems like you can resonate on that level with people. And I think that in our industry, which is known for being quite middle class or whatever, you guys have really hit that on the head. And do you think that's accurate to say?
Definitely. Tim and I have got very similar backgrounds. We both sort of come from sort of suburbia in
working class suburbia, I'd say.
So both experienced sort of the hell of the recession in the early 90s. Like, both our dads had their own businesses, which kind of ran into rocky ground. So, yeah, I guess so. I mean, our backgrounds are ridiculously similar. We went to the same gigs long before we knew each other and stuff.
Paths have crossed many times without really realising.
I think my mum will be destroyed that you've called her working class, though.
But I think that's part of it as well. And I think you're right. It's kind of, I think it's that era where I would say, we had a working class background, but the desire was that it wouldn't be working class. But I've always had a massive respect for both my parents, and my dad's work ethic was incredible because it was such a struggle. And I think that's something I've definitely taken forward into advertising. But it's very insightful. I mean, you nailed it on the head.
Well, I mean, the Vauxhall ad that you guys did, and there's real patriotism in that. And all the way throughout it, there's just these like little nuggets of, this is the way real people act, and this is the way real people live. And I wonder if, you know, the fact that you've ended up at the BBC, which is the every person company, was that something that was a conscious decision for you guys? Or
funny you mention our mums, because it was one of the things. Is like, I don't think my mum would have forgiven me if I didn't take it. It's like, it's like, fine. This is going back to
a
that
brand they realised.
Yeah, going back to that fresh call for entry film you said about. It sort of that came out of that, like you say, that notion.
What
as
do
well.
You do?
Yeah, it would be so much easier for our parents, or, you know, it would be so much easier for our mums if we were just electricians and plumbers.
Absolutely.
At least, you know, when they get together with their friends, they could say, you know, this is what my son does, this is what they do.
So my first boss, Mike, had a situation of he overheard his mum talking to her elderly friend about what he did, and she said, oh, Mike's a copywriter. And the friend goes, what does that mean? And she goes, well, you know, the adverts. He takes the adverts and he just copies out what they write. And it's like, oh, right, okay.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think my mum still... I call my mum every Friday on my drive home and talk about the week that I've had. I don't think she really... You know, she's very excited by it. But, yeah, as soon as the BBC came up, it was like, at least it's like...
Yeah,
Tim,
I think my mum and dad
get it, but again,
it's kind of the background, isn't it? It's like, I don't think they can... I still can't believe we get paid to do what we do. It's kind of... It's quite strange.
Yeah, now we get paid to do it at the BBC, which is pretty incredible.
I can relate to you on one level, especially with the family, because a couple of years back now, I got an ad out for Coke, and I sent a cold email to Graham Fink at Ogilvy, and you know, over a number of months, it ended up coming to fruition.
Oh, was the handshake one?
No, unfortunately not.
Sorry.
I wish it was. No, it was the follow-up that did not nearly as well, called the Coke Santa.
Okay. Oh, no, yeah. Definitely.
What was funny about it was instantly my dad thought that you could just throw ideas into the ether, and all of a sudden I started getting unsolicited phone calls at work where he'd watch the news and he had this idea about moles in a hole and a Snickers bar outside because he'd watched the local news about how they were trying to entice moles out of holes with nuts and stuff. And I was just like, Dad,
I suppose what we pick up on is the way someone would tell that story. So it's what your dad's doing. It's kind of that then we probably subconsciously throw into an ad somewhere down the line.
Yeah, no, I think it's kind of you become a sponge without really realising it. And I don't think your background can, you know, can't help but seep out somehow. Mm-hmm.
So you guys, I mentioned this in the intro, you've won nearly 130 awards now, and that's not easy to do for anyone. Over the years, what kind of tips and tricks have you picked up in order to actually get ideas through to fruition and not just lying in your sketchbooks?
It kind of comes from working not in London. There's a kind of, you very quickly realise you've got to work a little bit harder to prove yourself. Mm-hmm. And I think the agencies we were at in our early career, we were the only junior team. So there was a sort of a recession early 2000s, and then there was like a gap behind us so we were the youngest for a long time.
Yeah.
So I guess it's just working harder and you know, studying DNAD annuals. I think we both know years 99 to 2008 back to front, you know. But it's kind of, sort of learning from those around
you. If we were to appear on You Bet,
that's exactly the thing which I did was, everyone does, right? But a lot of people don't. It is, you study the annuals, you know the best directors, you know the art directors that were really influential or that were the repeat people in coming up through and what it was that they were doing.
I think as well, just to go back to the award thing as well, being regional, is a couple of things. I think the opportunities are fewer and farther between, so you take every opportunity and absolutely, you know, go at it 100% on everything. I think that's one thing, but I think also, I think just the way things are set there, I think you are able sooner and more often build a relationship with a client. So I think you have access to clients where you might not necessarily in a big London agency, and certainly some of the network. So you, even in a network agency, like, you know, we've spent a lot of our time in various McCann offices, even then you're still, you know, you're presenting work to clients, so you're there
nice guy though as well, not a girl, whatever, but you know, sometimes you get creatives with a little bit of an attitude that they need to, you know, dismiss every sort of account management comment they hear. But it's actually, I think we've learned that if you're actually quite nice to people and you get on, I think we've always been, we've gotten well in agencies because we're nice to work with.
And collaborative, and not just dismissing things. You know, there's a time and a place, you don't roll over and have your belly tickled every time, but
it's funny. It's within everybody that has come into this room and talked about their career and everything, everyone has been super, super lovely. In fact, the one guy that, bloody hell, from BBH, I've completely lost his name.
Ramsey.
Yeah, like he was the only guy that kind of fit the traditional, like, solid, quite combative agency mold. But actually, most people have just been as friendly as pie. But for some reason, every time there's a photo is taken, everyone sticks a stern face on. Stern face.
Do you know what that is? It's because if your photo's ever used with bad news, it says BBC lays off 1,000 people, and then it has a picture of Tim and I sort of grinning in anger. That's why they do it.
Right. Is that serious?
That's BBC PR protocol.
No, it's one of those things. I think it's one of those things that are stuck from, like, it's a it's an urban legend piece of advice, but we stick to it.
We stick to it.
Yeah.
There was other other photos. We were smiling. Yeah. I looked pretty sexy in them. Tim didn't like his. But
someone's got to just get a wink on or something.
Yeah.
Like,
really. Oh yeah, there were piggybacks, all sorts. Going, the behind the scenes is pretty incredible. Yeah. But,
you say in your bio that you made a lot of your superiors look good along the way, which I think is quite a...
That's quite a churlish comment, isn't it?
No, but it's oftentimes very true as well.
Yeah.
But seeing as you guys are now the senior figures, I thought maybe I could flip that and ask you, what are you looking for in young creatives that you can piggyback off and that you can make yourself look good from?
It's kind of as much, we were talking about this earlier, equal to talent is obviously very important, but passion and enthusiasm.
Yeah, work ethic, I think.
Yeah, actually goes such a long way, like a willingness to learn, not people, that are good that don't believe they're the finished product. There's nothing worse than someone who's, okay and thinks they're amazing. Mm. It's just really important.
I think it goes back to what we were saying about, like, you brought up that whole working class background thing, I think. And that was always the traditional setup, was it was the public school account people and the working class creative department. But I think we buy into that as well. Mm. And I think it's kind of, I think you just come out with a slightly different work ethic. And I think that desire and passion goes a long way. You know, I'd rather have, obviously talent's hugely important, but you can have all the talent in the world, and if you don't apply yourself and you're not driven, then you may as well not bother. Mm. And that's what that's what we would look for.
Yeah, I think oftentimes, I mean, you mentioned I'm at the Gate, which was typically in the past Dave Trott's place. Mm. But one of his thing was, you outwork people if you're lacking on that talent bit, and you can, you will inevitably get better and learn as a result of it. But just putting in the graft, I mean,
I think if you've got an ounce of talent with like tons and tons of effort and passion, then you can't, it goes a huge way.
You say you worked with some good people and some terrible people also. And
should we start with the terrible
ones? Well, I was going to say, you can't get through 10 years of advertising without having a few decent stories and mishaps. So I thought, well, maybe if you could share some of the more positive and negative experiences you've had along the way.
Okay, that's difficult.
I'm going to start with my favourite story. Boy, James thinks there's something more serious. That the week one of my very first job. This is a good way to sort of ingratiate yourself with the big dogs. I was at the urinal of the toilet in first week, and our CEO, owner of the firm, walked in and started going to the toilet next to me, and looked down and his glasses fell off into the urinal, and mid-flow. So, and ever since then, it's a real leveller to watch your superior piss all over his specs. So if you can fabricate that scenario, then you might go a long way. You've always got a good comeback.
I don't know if I've got too many serious stories on that. Again, like Tim, the only thing I often think of is the strip club story, but I don't know if I should tell it on a podcast.
Come on.
Oh, well, I was with an ECD. He knows who he is if he's listening. And we finished in a bar late at night. He said, let's go to a strip club. And I was like, oh, I'm not really. It's late. It's like 2 a.m. We had a pitch the following day, actually, at 9:30. Anyway, so got into the taxi, asked the taxi driver, can you take us to a strip club, please? And he's like, fine. So we went there. I kind of sat there, honestly, just sat there and watched this guy get lap dances. Yeah. And then we came out and got in the cab, and he goes, right, brothel. I was like, what? He goes, brothel. I said, oh, honestly, it's not really me. And he goes, you just sit in reception. I was like, okay, and at the time I was thinking, that's going to be quite interesting. Okay, fair enough. And then as I asked the taxi driver, who looked as shocked as I was, he just said, oh, well done, you've passed the test. I don't really believe it was a test. I think he realised how horrified we were.
Really?
So that was that.
Wow, that's an interesting one.
I think this business is brilliant for that sort of thing. I think anywhere you go day to day, I think a creative department is one of the best places to work, especially if you're young. I think it's just, there's just the day-to-day. I don't think, like, the fun you can have and still be paid, and the laughs you can have with your mates in a creative department, I think, like, you can't, I don't think you can beat it. And I think, that I think you develop, I think our work and our tone of voice has developed from that a little bit, and sort of, you know.
There's always a bit of carnage going on in one direction.
It's pretty savage, yeah.
Yeah, and it's kind of, it's like growing up with like 15 brothers where you're all trying to outdo each other and put each other down and take the piss out of each other.
So do you think, you know, this wasn't what this interview is necessarily about, and I've spoken in depth about this with other people, but you say with your brothers. So this is quite a heavily male-dominated industry, and it's...
Yeah, Tim's a massive sexist.
Yeah, so. Totally. Yeah. But I think, to be honest, I think that's one of the good things we've noticed. You know, the BBC is miles ahead. Our department is 50-50 men and women, and that's
yeah,
a brilliant
it's a
thing.
Big change. I mean, the first departments we worked in, it was you'd just female was very tokenistic a lot of the time. And, you know, I think actually we've probably hired more girls than boys, to be honest, over our career.
It's always something we've been massively
changing.
Of.
Yeah, it's definitely, and it's changing for the better. And I think all these initiatives are. Like She Says and all that sort of thing are amazing, fantastic. And we, Tim and I both went to an event in Manchester with an organisation called School of Thought, which is about gender diversity. And it's big news in Manchester, and we're really seeing an effect. It's good.
I was just talking to one of my colleagues about this today, that oftentimes when you're in London, you can go, sexism doesn't exist, and, you know, and nobody's... homophobic or you know, because there's just such diversity, but it tends to be outside of the main capital cities, and also where you get a lot of, I know in the West Midlands where my mum's from, you know, like there's massive disparity in groups there, and there's a lot more friction, and when you're in a culture that is mixed and it feels balanced, like how's that changed the work environment for you, other than it being a more positive thing? Do you think it's... can you see a difference?
Absolutely. I think gone are the days where Tim and I had to sit and write WKD ads, which are just knob jokes for other sort of 20-something blokes, really. Yeah. I think the work you get is far more varied and interesting, allows you to do more interesting things. I don't think this industry is there on racial diversity at all.
Yeah, I think that's the one thing with, you know, everywhere still a long way behind.
Yeah,
but I can't remember. I was listening to another, I think it was might have been Tim Lindsay talking about any sort of diversity in a creative department is massively important and critical, because you don't just want the... I think the worst thing an agency can have is a house style. And I think that agencies that do that, sometimes it comes down to, you know, a lack of diversity in the people that are doing the work, the people that are selling the work, the people that are writing the briefs, because I think any sort of difference in background helps, whether that's class, culturally, you know whether you're male or female. I think any sort of different points of view helps hugely in the work we're doing.
Bringing a different perspective.
But that's an issue in London, so it costs a lot to be on placement, for example, in London, so that instantly cuts off a lot of people from having that opportunity, I think, as well.
This is probably where we should do a little shout-out for the JOLT programme, which is an initiative that I've been part of, again, that helps a group of people into the industry, and there's several paid placements back to back. So if you are from outside of London and you're looking to break into the creative industries, do give the JOLT programme a Google.
Also come to the BBC in Manchester.
Yeah.
I mean, you're hard-pressed to come across too many better briefs than we get to work on.
Absolutely. And you can definitely afford a bigger flat as well.
And you can afford to live and eat there as well.
For years and years, brands have segmented percentages of their budgets to creative advertising agencies to create their campaigns. In recent years, however, due in part to the increase in financial pressure and competition that has sprouted from the internet, causing huge amounts of disruption in every sector, brands and large corporations have been questioning the norm, and on rare occasions, successfully bringing creative talent in-house. As a team who have had a successful career in advertising, I wanted to find out what their motivations were for the moving client side. Every creative who's ever worked in advertising will understand the struggle of actually getting what you want through to fruition. And now that you're client side, or when I say client side, you work within an in-house creative department. How has that process, which traditionally you have to go through several levels of hierarchy and getting it sent to the client and all that kind of stuff, how has that differed for you now that your creative's in-house?
We still have clients technically because
I think a hierarchy exists no matter where you go.
Yeah, the way at the BBC it works, you've got marketing teams which represent what are essentially our clients, so BBC Sport or children's charities, learning, whatever. So there's still an agency client relationship there. It's kind of, the boundaries are a little bit blurred because sometimes we're working together, they're briefing straight into, we don't have account management, for example.
So the good thing with that is that you kind of you're sitting in the same building as the people that are, you know, making decisions about your work, and you know, and you're able to have instant conversations with that person, and you're able to have instant conversation with that person face to face. Because I don't know how much work has died in our career through an email, you know, conversation gone awry, or you know, it's better to, things can be headed off at the pass much quicker. You can go and have a conversation with someone and you know, and solve a problem in minutes rather than 27 emails. At which point you lost the will to live.
There's obviously brands out there that in recent years have been extremely successful at bringing creative in-house to some degree. I know that Red Bull's been a prime example of someone that have effectively created their own media network. Paddy Power have been notorious for having their in-house social media team, I believe, that are very reactive to things which are going on. And then obviously a couple years ago, or over the last however many years, I don't know when it was founded, but 4Creative have produced a whole bunch of exceptional work, and it's often cited that BBC Creative was kind of created off as in order to mirror that what they've created. Do you think that this is a prevailing shift, and is it merely just a financial one, or do you think that, you know, now brands and companies can start to bring creative in-house?
I think as long as you're doing it for the right reasons, on the what you're saying about, obviously BBC Creative is, you know, you see the success of 4Creative, and that's a big driver. There is a cost saving element,
Definitely.
But there's also a massive culture change from where the BBC was when it was Red B, sort of doing the creative.
You can't not look at 4Creative and, you know, hold that as a benchmark in the work that they've created. Yeah, it's incredible stuff. But I think at the same time, I think BBC were probably the last broadcasters not to have an in-house agency, and it seems a bit mad now. We're 9 months in, but BBC Creative as an entity, 2 years in, the level of work that you can do and the quality control that you can have over, you know, sort of working in in-house, and I think for us point of view, to draw us into that world is I don't think that ad agency creative departments are the place that great work is going to be done, or if it is being done.
I think you've got to be careful though. You sort of look at Pepsi and what they did in-house, and I think as long as you're
anywhere can do terrible work though, can't it?
As long as it doesn't exist in a vacuum. But I think you've got to do it for the right reasons. It can't be because Mr. Marketing Director would like to be Creative Director, actually. You know, Specsavers, it works well. Certain other people I won't mention doesn't work at all well. And so, it's a false...
So just for people that, you know, for anyone that's listening to this who doesn't work in advertising, that may not even be aware of the fact that oftentimes brands... they push out their creative to advertising agencies who come up with ideas, who then pitch it back to them, their clients buy it, they produce it. Oftentimes you can have agencies that produce stuff for brands that is very similar to another brand, but they're doing something very completely different. We're effectively moulding and shaping the way that these brands are perceived in public perception. What you talk there, you make a very, very good point about it shouldn't be Mr. Marketing Person saying that they want to be creative director. But obviously, when you mentioned Specsavers and a few of these other places that have done it successfully, Is it because they have this effectively an ECD or a creative director at the helm that just so happens to be client side? I mean,
yeah, I think so. I think often you're these in-house places will be established by people that have been outside. But I mean, there's other ways of in-house can work. So a lot of places have an in-house design department, or they do their packaging in-house or whatever. But I think you've just got to do it for the right reasons, really. I think cost is obviously a motivation, but
yeah, I think that is obviously going to be a driving factor. And when it comes to the BBC, it's like a critical point of view, because the country pays for that. So if there's a way of doing better work in a better way, then I don't know why wouldn't you do that. And as long as you bring in the right people, I mean, from day one, the people that are being brought in to run BBC Creative are incredibly talented, savvy people. And started by Justin at the top, who comes from an agency background. He's been at the BBC a long time, but knows that world. And I think that's why it works well, because he has a perspective on both sides. So he spent 10 or 15 years at the BBC, but before that he was running agencies. So it's kind of, he's the perfect person to do this. And I think, it having one eye on both worlds is really important.
I don't think it'll be the end of agencies.
No, definitely kind of, agencies will always exist.
I wouldn't go in-house if it was, say it was Dunlop Tyres, because you're just going to be working on one product, aren't you? But I think with the BBC, it's like being in a sweet shop with the briefs and the amount of clients within the big client.
Yeah, it's kind of got, it's brands that exist within the BBC portfolio that, an agency would kill for one of them, and they all exist for us to, they're all there for us to work. So it's difficult when you first start. It is like being a kid in a sweet shop, and you have to kind of temper yourself to know when to go at something and know when to, judging what the work needs, what the job needs.
You briefly mentioned there that this stuff is paid by TV licensing, effectively. I'm just curious to know, how do they determine what percentage of money is allocated to a given creative brief inside?
Well, that's above our pay grade. But we could probably do the whole podcast about the briefing structure of the BBC. The BBC, but it's basically down to the cultural significance of the thing that you're promoting to a degree. I mean, and that's, the BBC as a company is creating culture day in, day out, and our job is to establish that for in marketing terms. So if something like the World Cup, has a huge cultural impact, so therefore you need the right level of resource to support that. And
you guys are going to be well positioned for that next year.
We already are.
Hopefully, a touch word. Yeah,
we already are. I think.
Yeah. Ask us next week.
Yeah.
When you move into an agency like BBC Creative, obviously it's for you guys, it's a bit of a Wild West scenario where you didn't necessarily know what you were going there and what you were going to expect. You've mentioned many of the pros of working in that environment, but if you could take anything away from the creative agencies that you've worked at for many years and implant into BBC, what is there anything you missed?
I miss my iPhone 7.
Eight now.
I think there's a slightly different culture in marketing. I think agency side people tend, generally speaking, to be a bit more entrepreneurial. There's maybe not that environment at the BBC. We always say that the psychopaths are on show in an ad agency, where they're a little bit more disguised at the BBC. Yeah. It's a far nicer environment, which is good, and in some ways maybe holds you back, because there's less controversy.
It's good to be called a bastard right away than sort of that sort of like passive aggressive. Yeah. 2 week period where everyone's trying to play nice, where you could have just got to the result a lot quicker.
Sure.
I think, I think it's all, like, one of the big benefits of the BBC is its editorial and its editorial approach and the content that it puts out. Sometimes that can have a heavy influence over the marketing, and they're two different things. And I think that's still something that, you know, like I say, it's still very, very new, and over time
it's
will
a,
be...
BBC Creative is a massive cultural change.
Yeah, within the BBC, I mean, it's a huge shift. I mean, it's a small amount of people and a massive pool of people trying to have a huge impact and a huge change.
Looking through your body of work, you've done some amazing stuff for the likes of Domino's, Vauxhall, Harley Davidson, all of which looks like it, you know, it's directly from a concept, and then you've made this thing come from nothing and into fruition to be something. This isn't a criticism by any means, but I wondered, when I looked through some of the BBC stuff, it looks like you're oftentimes working with pre-existing assets. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if that was a frustrating aspect for you.
No, I think it was, we were hesitant when we got the sort of initial concept from the BBC, thinking, well, we don't want to be, you know, spending all our time cutting trails. I think the using existing assets is a way of, you know, there's a cost-saving thing to it, of course, but it's not everything we do. We have sort of original content that we develop. Obviously, we're making, I don't know, it's like 800 campaigns a year or something. So not all
don't
of them
quote
can
us
get
on those figures.
don't quote us. Obviously, it's sort of, they can't all have an equal slice of the pie. Mm. So we tier our campaigns. So the big campaigns are what we call gold, and then there's a slightly lower budget with silver and bronze. And the bronze campaigns
tend to be clip-based.
Yeah, they tend to be clip-based.
But there's creative opportunities within that.
Yeah,
you know, it's the brief and the problem remains the same. You've got a product to sell, and you need to sell it in the most interesting, most creative way possible. Mm. If that's with pre-existing assets, then you know there's still a level of quality and a bar to be set. But I think the amount of output that BBC Creative go through, I mean just the department that we look after on sport and children's, is kind of it's a huge agency's worth of business. And I think in any agency, then there's a certain amount of, I don't want to say churn because it's not even that, because there's some amazing work that's done, but there's always going to be a layer of
this needs to be done.
Yeah, this needs to be done, but it still needs to be done. Yeah, but also, but it's kind of like still needs to be done in the best possible way. And then above that, there's new stuff to be created, new content creation. So we've just come. One of the first things we worked on was Children in Need. All that's, you know, I would say, well, 75% of that is generated content on, you know, shoots and production in the way you would at an agency, you know, and then you'd still do your clip-based stuff as well.
We just had Tim Lindsay into the agency that I work at today to give an hour-long talk with regard to the kind of stuff that was doing well at DNAD this year. And he made a kind of brief sweeping statement, which, don't quote him on the numbers, I don't think, but he said out of the roughly 500 campaigns that they awarded pencils to, only 30 in this year's annual were awarded to campaigns that you would traditionally call an ad.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Like either a standard print ad or just a typical TV ad. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you're seeing a lot more of, and what are you kind of briefed to create? Is it always...
Well, I think we're briefed to create the best work we can for the project. Obviously, we've got the world's biggest terrestrial channels are free media, so we're going to use that. But
yeah, there's always going to be a certain amount of seconds that needs to be filled across the BBC. So broadcast is often your first touch.
But there's,
point.
I mean, we're trying to move very much into a space where we're doing work that's not traditional. So the guys have just done a campaign for iPlayer called Make Me, which is all about you decide your mood. So you want to, you know, if it's, you say make me happy, and it lists you a load of content. So it's just thinking differently. And you know, that we live in a world where there's so many sort of touch points. I don't know if I've ever used that word before. But, you know, so how do we get to the different and new and exciting ways of getting to the audience?
Well, I think, that's going to... The exciting thing about BBC Creative and the big challenge is the challenge that lies ahead for the BBC, because there isn't a traditional audience sat there waiting to be served 40-second, 30-second pieces of content in an ad break, and that's... And that's going to, you know, that's it's going to be interesting how the BBC model evolves to cope with that. And, you know, the competitors aren't ITV and Channel 4 anymore, just those guys anymore. It's YouTube as much as anything.
I mean, what do the audience demographics look like for the BBC these days? Because I imagine that that's changed a dramatic amount over the last...
We've got a gap of I think it's like age
12 to 16
is kind of, it's like a generation that goes missing.
And yeah, you go out to see BBC and when you come back in, there's nothing.
Yeah. You know. So a lot of our remit is to engage younger audiences.
The whole remit for the BBC is to, you know, the job ahead and going back to that point about what's the landscape going to look like, do we have to, you know, you've got to redefine the BBC for a younger audience. And
it's very corporate, is Tim. Yeah, good line.
Well, yeah. No, you can imagine, so, you know, Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, all of these services are popping up online, and YouTube, and as you've mentioned. And
well, kids are watching Peaky Blinders on Netflix, and it's like, well, that's a BBC.
It's like, yeah, that's true, but it's, you can imagine that it, a lot of brands have to change their messaging and in order to, so that when fresh blood comes around, it's given a whole new set of messages that people don't remember. It's why young people are so inspirational in general, is because they have none of the biases that you get as you get older. So they're just more optimistic in general. But for the BBC nowadays, I mean, they're struggling with that audience, surely. And are they going to end up having to restructure the way people consume that stuff?
I don't know what...
I mean, iPlayer is the biggest channel, if anything.
I think the second biggest brand in the BBC portfolio is iPlayer, behind BBC One. That's where people are consuming a lot of their media. So it's begun in a way.
Yeah, the BBC has a duty to serve. So I think it's always a case of we'll evolve with their audiences. We have to, as our public duty.
And that is, you know, that's not BBC, just BBC's great BBC creative remit. That is the BBC's remit from the top down. It's from programming to marketing, all of it. It's how do we continue to engage those evolving audiences?
So just to push back on this from a tech and trying to work out the mindset of young people, like when you land on a BBC iPlayer, you're asked, I believe, for your age and if you've got a TV license.
Yeah.
So you're putting up a wall straight away, and for young people who aren't even into that kind of stuff, they're likely to just disperse.
Yeah, I mean, when you arrive at Netflix, you've got to give them your details. You just don't have to pay $7.99 a month.
Yeah.
You've already got paying your TV license. So I think, I don't know if it's, you know, there's
a sign-in process.
There's a sign-in process to anything,
isn't established, which do that once and then hopefully you're around.
But that's to, you know, there's a signing process been introduced, but it's to allow the BBC to serve people content relevant to themselves. So it's done for an end goal, for a benefit. There's such a huge amount of content across the BBC, everyone wants something different, so to have that information, you can serve people the best content.
Yeah, definitely.
In the final segment of the interview, I wanted to ask Tim and James what continues to motivate them to this day. Having accomplished more than I imagined they ever dreamed possible when they came into the industry, I wanted to know if they still feel that they've accomplished all there is to do and what they are planning to do moving forward. Moving on to the kind of final segment of the interview, where I'd like to, if it's okay with you guys, try and extract just some valuable insights for people that would like to kind of emulate your path and be in the position that you guys are moving forward. That being said, I always like in these last parts to kind of get honest with my guests. Mm-hmm. And I always wonder, when you've done as much as you have, do you ever just have the feeling that you want to kind of clap your hands together and be like, right, we're done? Like, you know, you've won all the awards, you've done the big brand campaigns. What motivates you to this day?
To make stuff.
From
a junior to a senior, you just want to make stuff. And if that's, I guess, as you work your way up in creative directors like we are now, it's to see, help other people make things. I think as a creative, that's your goal, and going back to our current role, at BBC Creative, we make stuff every single week. Whereas, you know, across a year at an agency, you might make three or four things. We're making three or four things a month. So it's, you know, it's, yeah, I think you just,
it's
got,
always
you just
want to wanting make things. To do it better as well. So I'd hate to think that I've already done my best work.
Yeah.
Is a big motivator, and it's kind of a, you know, it's quite scary. You think if it all ends tomorrow, then oh god, is that my legacy? I can do better than that. Surely.
Yeah, and it's always that. I don't know. I think we've always, perhaps that's why we've done well, is we've always had that desire, a, to not, you know, to once you've done something, not to a rest on your laurels or to wallow in its disappointment, but to sort of just move on to the next thing.
Yeah,
you know,
and I think that doesn't leave creatives. Better. I don't think either. It's
maybe it does, and that's when they, you know, they go, you know, people go off, leave the industry, and do other things, but or look for that elsewhere. But I think, you know, again, it's early days for us at BBC Creative, but I think we've at the moment we've found that at BBC Creative for sure, because just I think we've made our output is way more in the 9 months we've been at BBC Creative than it probably was in two or three years at our previous agency.
I mean, you guys are pretty fortunate. You've worked together for a long time, and oftentimes in the trajectory of a person's life, they'll go off in different directions. And it's expected within the creative industry a lot of the times that you find a partner and that you progress on this journey together. I'm sure there's been times when you just want to gouge each other's eyes out. I mean, what's the secret to you guys?
Just bottle it up.
If I moan and shout at Tim, he just kind of ignores me, which, so we don't really... we do, I think we argue. I don't think we hold a grudge. We know it's about work. It's not personal. But then again, you know, you kind of, I think over a time as a team, you kind of get a sixth sense that you kind of know what each other's thinking. And, you know, I know if Tim's going to love something or be slightly disappointed by something or the, you know, vice versa, I'm sure as well.
I think you sort of like, what is it? Over 10 years we've been working together. I think you kind of, yeah, you just sort of develop a sort of a way of working and sort of like a sixth sense about what each other's doing and where what the other one, you know, and without even, if you've got a job on, especially now, we've got 8 briefs, they almost file themselves to you know, either one of us quite naturally, because we kind of know each other's, you know, likes, dislikes, skills, who's best to deal with what, really.
I was going to mention this. So I used to work in teams. I tend to work as a solo now, but whenever we used to have a disagreement, our tactic was to basically each allow each other to have one idea that one of us didn't believe in, you know, that would get thrown into the mix. So it'd be like,
I don't think we've ever done that, really. It's kind of, if Tim or I think the other one's idea is rubbish, we say so, and then the other one kind of gives up because the other one's not.
Or just puts it in anyway. I think it's kind of, as the other person, you kind of got to understand that, you know, there's going to be times when there might be a piece of work that you don't wholeheartedly believe in, but if you're going to develop a working relationship with someone, sometimes you don't necessarily know best, and you kind of let that person.
I mean, yes, kind of recently we're sort of both on the same project managing different teams because we both prefer, each one of us prefers the other bit of work. But it's not to say we dislike the other bit, but it's kind of, yeah, we don't agree all the time, but I don't think when we finish something, we look back and think, I wish we'd have made that other route.
Yeah, and also I think, like you were touched upon, I think we have very similar upbringings. We have very similar interests. So kind of, I think the work we do comes from a similar like background, and our cultural references are quite similar. So it's not...
Yeah, well, I think we CD each other, really, generally. So, you know, I'll always ask Tim's opinion if I'm working separately, and Tim never asks mine, actually, if it comes to think of it.
It's hard to talk about, because I think it is one of those things after 10 years becomes sort of second nature, so it's hard to articulate, but I think you
get to know each other's.
Yeah, as like an old married couple,
it is my longest relationship. So
you say you CD one another, but how have you creatively approached CDing other people? Like, what What techniques do you use to work with younger creatives?
A lot of encouragement and honesty, I think, rather than... I'm not a fan of skirting around an issue to save someone's feelings, but, you know, I'll make sure that they know, like, on a level, X is not going to be sold because of this. If you don't change it, then it's not going to get bought.
Yeah, and I think also it's not... I think we're... Well, I hope we're pretty good at not... I think the worst creative directors... imprint their ideas onto your ideas. Mm. I think what we try and do is, obviously, in the first instance, make the work that's presented as good as it can be, but then your role is kind of to use your experience to shepherd it through,
yeah,
and make it buyable and make it sellable and sort of enhance that idea, but yeah, make it, you know the likes and dislikes of your client or whoever that might be, and making sure you use your experience to make it, yeah, bulletproof, really.
It's learning as well from the good and the bad that you've been CD'd by. So the best CDs we've had are the ones that have been very clear. The worst ones are the ones that kind of go, can you make it a bit more, you know, or whatever.
Or that you sit in their office going through the work and as they're saying, you're going, yep, totally got it. And we both get back to our office and you're like, so what are we doing? It's like, and he's like, oh, I thought you knew.
That's so
clear,
stressful.
And concise,
yeah. Yeah, just so we're concise and nice.
Oh, hello. Copywriter over
there.
Yeah,
there you go. I wondered, I noticed on your site that you're going to drop a short film.
Yeah,
in
the bin.
This seems to be something that a lot of creatives do, that they go and they produce their film, you know,
yeah.
And there's almost a little hidden secret that a lot of creatives want to go and secretly become a director or be an artist or something. I mean, do you guys ever think, you know, fuck, we're making ads at the end of the day, I wish I was...
Yeah,
the ones making.
Sometimes you can. I think sometimes you look at what a director's being paid and you think, I could do that. But I think you kind of recognise your. So we both directed ads before.
As part of the BBC, you kind of have to do a little bit of that anyway.
Yeah, the whole writing thing. I mean, the writing that film is actually an adaptation of one of our best mates' short stories, and it's one of those things where I just like to tick things off. So I suppose the screenwriting thing isn't a burning desire. It's kind of, well, you know, I'll have a go at it. Can I do it? Oh, it's all right, actually.
And it's a bucket list item.
Yeah, kind of. And you can kind of, you know, I've kind of scratched that itch, you know, it's like being in a band. Just do it. You need to play on stage once and you're okay, I've done it now. I don't need to keep going. Yeah.
If it's okay with you guys, I wondered if you could both name one person throughout the your rise to where you are now, and what it was about that individual that you particularly admired, or just someone that's been influential in for you guys.
In the industry, you mean?
Yeah, or just, I mean,
we've worked with specifically,
or it could be a mentor, but just I know for me personally, I can put my finger on a few people who have steered my path, and I've taken lessons away from them that will inevitably changed the trajectory of my life.
I think it's difficult to narrow it down to one as such, because I think in your career you work with so many people that I think you naturally soak up the good and the bad of everyone. And I think if you're sensible, you do anyway, without thinking about it too much. But
well, maybe another way to frame it is, if you were to say, what's a characteristic that you particularly admire in colleagues or people that are your superiors? Mm. What is it that you think accounts for a lot of people's success?
If I was to pinpoint a person, then it would be our ECD at Birmingham, Vince McSweeney. And it was because he came at a point in our careers where we were sort of making that transition into senior creatives and moving into more, you know, and now where we are now in sort of management, is kind of his management style was good, and just the drive and passion. I mean, his standards were hugely high against the work, but also the way that he, you know, made everyone feel within the department sort of the drive outside of it, so the initiatives that he put together, and sort of it's not just about, as a creative director, you know, judging the work, it's creating that culture in a department as well. It didn't suit everyone. Mm. It suited us really well. We really enjoyed it.
Yeah, definitely.
So I'd say that I think he had the biggest effect on me from learning that the culture of a department is as important, if not more important in some ways, as the work they're doing, because one will influence the other.
Yes. Oh, this is such a tricky question. There's been kind of lots for me. There's the start of my career, a guy called Mike Johnson, who sort of took a chance on me when I didn't really have a portfolio. We spoke about Led Zeppelin for an hour, and at the end of that, he gave me a job.
He's
kind of guided me a bit.
Sorry to cut you off there, but I think, you know, you make a really valid point there, which is I often tell people, just be interesting, you know, and the best thing you can possibly do when you walk into a room is to spark up an hour-long conversation about an interest or a passion, or, you know, or to know something about what they're interested in and to talk about that. And oftentimes, knowing that you're a decent human being that's inquisitive and enthusiastic can get you through those tricky situations.
Yeah, it's kind of, I suppose, I mean, creative, that's, you're right, you're bang on, just kind of the conversations when you do a book crit, it's not necessarily the work you remember, it's the person.
But also it's like when you go into you go into client presentations, it's often the, and pictures as well, it's the 5 or 10 minutes before and after the presentation that can seal the deal. And I think
you try not to ask, say, some inane comment about the weather is usually a good way to begin.
Yeah.
And just
having the ability to strike up a conversation. We worked with Billy Mulwinney for a little bit, and he would just, like, going into a creative presentation or a pitch, just have a very easy style of chat and just instantly could strike up a conversation with someone. And then we worked with Steve Henry for a little bit at McCann Birmingham as well, came in as a sort of a mentor to our CD there. Having good stories as well
he's another person. Like, our paths crossed briefly, but his influence on us was ginormous, gave us that sort of self-belief that, you know, try and do something beyond what they're asking you to do.
Yeah.
But before I get into the quickfires, I'll just ask you one more question, which is, given the opportunity to go back to your 20-year-old selves and with all the experience you've got now, what would you have changed? What would you advise somebody that's looking to break into the scene now?
20-year-old self.
Yeah, stop eating kebabs.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, stop working at Blockbuster. I came quite late, so I didn't start.
Yeah.
I didn't start working in the industry until I was 25.
I went to Bucks, which has got a famous ad course, but I didn't do the ad course. So advertising came kind of late for me. I kind of found myself in it.
I'd say to, like, probably go back further than that and be a bit more self-aware. Because when I look back at it now and the career I've had, I remember loving advertising, but I didn't realise that I loved advertising. And it's kind of, I think, a self-awareness of what you're into. I had a Star Wars taped on a VHS, and I remember the ads as much as anything. The Scotch tape ad, and there was an
Steve
ad.
Steve Henry, that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, nice callback. There was an ad for Daz washing up powder that I remember, and so that was probably when I was 6 or 7, so it took me another 20 years to realise that I liked advertising. So be more self-aware.
Yeah, definitely. And sort of, I think what enrages me about students, especially people who have done specifically ad courses, which I don't think are actually that good. What you're interested in, and then I think that's the secret of a happy life. Do what makes you happy. You know, for a long time, till I was sort of 20 or 21, I thought I wanted to work in the city or just make loads of money. But then you soon realise that actually life's not about that. It's about, being happy in what you do. So find what makes you happy. It's a massive cliche. And then follow that.
If we put out any quote from this, it'll be The thing which makes you happy is to
concise
do what makes
and nice.
You happy.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that what I said?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
No.
Yeah, we'll edit this. It'll be fine.
Edit,
you said you like simplicity in your bio,
yeah,
right?
So yeah. Whatever makes you happy.
Be happy.
Yeah. Crikey.
Just to throw some quick fire questions at you. So, is there a book you would recommend to any aspiring creative?
I think one that I really like is the one that Sell, I think they're called, did. I think it's called How to Make Better Advertising, Advertising Better. Is a really cool. But then a book for an aspiring creative, just go and buy DNA Daniel.
Yeah. See, well, but and also buy DNA Daniel from 1999. Get the old ones.
Yeah.
God, gold, 1999 is old now, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is, isn't it?
It's a long time ago.
I think it's hard with industry books because they evolve so quickly, so they become outdated quickly. I remember, like, I don't know, Hey Whipple was
yeah, there's an old book called,
I don't know how relevant it is now, but I'm sure, I mean, it's about how to have ideas, isn't it? So that's as relevant
Tim
as anywhere.
That one as well,
yeah,
so
I mean, that's a good one. Yeah. Hegarty's book's always good as well.
Hegarty's does a good one. Yeah. Trott does a good one.
Yeah, Predatory Thinking's good. Yeah.
If you could, this is a new quick fire, so I don't know how successful it's going to be, but if you could choose one thing to download into your brain in a single second, what would you learn?
Don't know.
one thing to download into my...
So instinctively, when I wrote this, I was, it was, you know, development skills or something like that, because they're so sort of...
Like a skill set.
Yeah.
So I'm in the Matrix and, and you can learn Kung Fu.
Exactly where the inspiration
came from. Can I say
Kung
Fu? I don't know. Okay.
Don't look at me, I'm blank.
I mean, honestly, oh, to God, I don't know. I wish I could draw better.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
The ability to answer any question with wit and charm.
That'd be a good one. A newsletter that people should subscribe to.
I don't know about newsletters, but I listen to a... I think, being on a podcast, I think we both listen to a lot of podcasts.
Yeah.
So I subscribe to as many of those as you can.
Yeah. What are some of your favourites?
Yours, Ricky. Ben Kay is obviously really good. There's one I've been listening to called Fearless. And the guy's got this sort of dreadful mid-Atlantic accent. If you can get past that, it's really good. And that's all about creativity and management and... stuff like that.
I like the ramblings of Dave Dye as well. I like the fact that his podcasts are like 3 hours long.
They just go on. They're like, it's an art director podcast, got no chip filters too much.
It's so true. Yeah. It is, as an art director, it's so true, but maybe that's why I like it. So up until recently, staying up in Manchester while living elsewhere, and I was living in Oxfordshire. So I'd spend a lot of time in the car, so I could while away a 3 hour commute with a single Dave Dye blog, and I was a big fan of that.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd have to turn it off after an hour.
It's rife within our industry to be quite anxious and to be workaholics, but what do you guys do to relax, for downtime?
I like to watch films, if I was honest. I'll watch films and run. That's pretty much... and go out and eat food. They're the three things that I do outside of work, basically.
Yeah, exercise is important. My girlfriend Emma and I try and do things that we've never done before, and that can be as simple as going to a new... You know, we're going to an indoor crazy golf place in a few... And, you know, it's kind of... That sounds a bit lame, but it's, just variety and keeping yourself fresh.
Just switching off.
Yeah.
You're being able to just look forward to sitting on the sofa with my wife watching some crap TV. Because it is hard to switch, or it can be hard to switch off, because it is, you know, it's the, when you work in a creative industry, it's not a, you can't shut your laptop down at the end of the day and that's it, you're not working. It's kind of, your brain will continue to tick over, but it's really important to switch off. The amount of times that I've sat all day thinking about something, and then the minute you switch off from it, or you, lightning strikes when you're getting out of the shower.
Take issues home with you, so...
don't take it too seriously. Either.
Yeah, so the best advice I was given was, it's only ads.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, actually, yeah, you're right, it's not... We're not going to remember this next time.
I mean, you know, it's... do a good job, work hard, but maintain perspective as well.
Yeah.
Just to finish up on the quickfires, say someone listening to this has absolutely loved everything you've said and would love to
Seems unlikely.
Yeah.
Would love to swoon you with a gift.
I'm still devastated by the happy comment.
What would be a good gift for you guys?
Would be a good gift.
Topical with it being Christmas.
I'm in the market for some new headphones, actually. These headphones, at least free.
God, what would be a good gift? I don't know. My mum keeps asking me this, what I want for Christmas. I don't know.
It gets harder. It definitely gets harder as you get older because you kind of, you have the stuff, don't
yeah.
you?
Yeah, and it's just a lifetime supply of eating out wherever I want.
Yeah.
If we can arrange that.
Yeah. Anyone out there.
Headphones.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I'm in a studio, you must have our spares.
So before I ask the final question, reveal how people can get hold of you, I'm going to pass the show over to our producer Adam, who's going to share some actual insights from our interview today.
James, Tim, thank you for joining us today, and thank you for the wealth of insight you shared with us. Here's the five actionable insights that I wrote down as you were talking. Number one, beware of relying on research. It can result from people being asked to have an opinion. Number two, passion, enthusiasm, and a good work ethic can be just as important as the quality of your work. If you're not driven, you may as well not bother. Number three, speaking to a colleague face-to-face can keep an idea alive. Don't let never-ending emails kill an idea. Number four, in teams, you don't always know which of your ideas will work, so try being each other's creative director. And number five, if you have the power to, try to positively influence the culture of a department, as it's just as important as the work it produces. The two go hand in hand.
Thank you, Adam. Some really great insights there. So to sum up, before I ask you the final question, where can people get hold of you, and do you have any asks for the audience?
If you want to get hold of me, speak to James.
Yeah.
James is like our... Every job we've ever moved to has come through James. He's like our PR machine.
So I'm on the Twitter... at James PL Cross. I'm on Instagram. That's private though, so don't follow me there. And I've recently got into LinkedIn. I've realised that you can write something sort of slightly controversial and get loads of likes,
right? Yeah,
and comments, which I'm quite addicted to. And yeah. That's quite funny. And
I'm on LinkedIn, but I think it still says I work at McCann Manchester. Yeah. So sorry about. I'm on Instagram as well, but I don't really know what my name is on it.
And what's your website address?
timandjames.co.uk.
Yeah, well, I was going to say bbccreative.co.uk. Don't go and look at our website.
Don't go to timandjames.com. It's a very different website.
Yeah, there's a gay couple who post their holiday snaps there. It's entertaining for us.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah. So final question. I wish we could have ended it there, but if you had the opportunity to give the world one piece of advice to live a better and more meaningful life, what would you give them, or what would you say?
I think I've already said it, Ricky, is do what makes you happy.
Yeah.
I think it's really
in
important.
Order to be happy, be happy. I think probably touched on it earlier, but I think work hard and be nice to people is an industry standard, but I think it's really, really true. And that's twofold, is have the work ethic, but don't be a dick.
Don't be a dick. I'll echo that. Don't be a dick.
Right, we'll end it there, guys. Cheers. Thanks very much.
Thank
it was
you.
Lovely to have you on.
Cheers, Ricky.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to subscribe and share. I'd also like to invite you to an ongoing project called the Move Me Mailing List. If you enjoyed the show, I'm confident you'll enjoy this newsletter. It contains links to all the great content I've uncovered each month, along with insights of any interesting opportunities I've discovered. You can subscribe to this by visiting my website at rickyrichards.com. A special thanks to Frankie Byrne and James Utting. They're the tech heads that make this show possible. The intro music was composed by Dom Stores Fox, and thanks again to Reese Chapman for introing me to Lou and Lizette, the wonderful folks at Factory Studios in London, where this show is recorded. Finally, wherever you are in the world, I hope you have a great day and keep creating. Until next time, bye for now.